Welcome to the Deep Further Fact. So I'm recording this on October 15, 2016. The election has been over for a week, and the launch of my podcast was significantly delayed as the election approached. I was more or less ready to launch it in September, but I found myself distracted by the constantly changing events that made up this crazy election cycle. You know, there were the debates, you know, the so-called October surprise, and there were several of those, and so on. Now, I voted for Bernie Sanders in the primaries, who failed to secure the Democratic nomination, as you are aware. And I mention this because as I noticed the election approach, I formed an allegiance to Hillary Clinton that got stronger and stronger as time went on. I started defending her to my colleagues, you know, who opposed her. I started liking her. I found myself unaware of the details of her email scandal story and rushed to play catch-up with them as if I was motivated to learn just enough detail that I could then speak authoritatively about how the scandal was overblown and irrelevant. Now, I'm mentioning this stuff to illustrate how I went through transformations many of us go through, transformations based on tribalism and in-group, out-group thinking, and obviously not that of pure rationality. The fact that I went from being lukewarm about Clinton in the beginning to fully supporting her is telling, and I can admit this not because I am comfortable with it, but rather it is easy to see how this phenomenon catches so many of us in its grasp. It is infinitely easier, of course, to see this phenomenon in others. I doubt I will ever be able to exercise myself fully of it. I'm not even sure if that's a necessary goal, but keeping oneself in constant check surely is worth pursuing, and that's part of why I'm talking about this. So my goal for this episode is simply to reflect on some of the more personal aspects of the way this election seemed to me, and what I think it means moving forward. So the first area I want to touch upon is how we view each other, how we view others. So the vitriol in the immediate aftermath of this election is stunning. I think just about every commenter agrees that this is about the worst they have ever seen in terms of backlash and the flaring of tempers and so on. I'm most struck by how our default views of our neighbors simply comes down to the least charitable interpretation of whatever it is they did, you know, in this case, the direction they cast their ballot. You know, the Donald Trump supporter responding to the protesters in the aftermath of the election tends to consider them silly and inconsistent with their professed acceptance of democratic rule. And basically, they believe the protesters are being whiny. Whiny babies. On the other side, the non-Trump supporter, you know, recoiling from learning so many of her neighbors voted for a man who openly courted racial violence at his rallies, couldn't help but find herself questioning the supporter's individual character. You know, the racist, misogynistic, xenophobic hysteria that peppered so much of Trump's campaign apparently wasn't a deal breaker for the Trump supporters, and their opponents consider them morally inferior for it. You know, once you go down the rabbit hole of questioning the possibility of basic goodness in your neighbors, digging your way out requires a level of goodwill that most people simply don't appear willing to offer, at least not yet. You know, staying down there in the rabbit hole apparently is easier. And I'm absolutely guilty of this too. Sometimes the temptation to insult those who disagreed with me was too great, as I could see no reasonable explanation for their preferences that didn't end with my concluding their ability to see things clearly was just flawed, and fundamentally so. And this illustrates one form of reasoning and judgment I have believed many of us operate under. You know, consider an analogy to math. Take a function like A equals B times C. A part of algebra is understanding what happens when you hold a variable constant and seeing how the remaining ones behave. So if you mentally hold the A constant, you can see that as B goes up, C must go down. You know, and you can do this with any function. And we seem to do the same thing to each other in our mental assessments. How many times have you heard someone say, for example, they found quitting smoking easy, and the implication was it should be easy for you too? Or that kids didn't behave in certain ways in some past era, implying the current ones shouldn't either. Or any other behavior where one has triumphed and another has failed. The logic we seem to believe is that our brains have something like a math function, and free will is one of the main variables that apparently we all share in equal quantity. So the smoker who once quit mentally holds your free will constant and asks why you didn't quit smoking since he or she found it so easy. And there aren't many answers to this question possible other than a statement about something lacking in your fortitude. You know, they quit smoking, you couldn't. You both have the same free will, so what went down must have been your strength, which is to say, you were weaker. And we seem to reason this way all the time about each other. Now, the aftermath of this election has caused both sides to ask this of the other. Why couldn't you do or say what I did and said? Why wasn't such and such a deal breaker for you? Now, let me be clear. I realize I'm engaging in, you know, quote, fair and balanced, you know, type of talk as if I believe there's an equivalence between the two sides. The truth is I do not see them equivalently at all and never have. I voted for Hillary Clinton because I believe she had a cool head, was smart, knowledgeable, and her flaws, particularly the email scandal that was hammered on relentlessly in the news, seemed overblown and based on histrionics. Donald Trump, on the other hand, always seemed like a sociopathic bullshitter. To the extent he made claims of any substance, which was rare, he almost never got anything right, certainly not in economics. He frequently contradicted himself in the same sentence. You know, so to the extent his noises resembled anything like grammar, he was basically bullshitting all the time. He doesn't appear to know anything. He doesn't appear willing to learn anything. And what struck me most was how often his campaign tanked because of his own apparent lack of self-control. He engaged in a media battle with the cons, that's the parents of a fallen army captain, against the advice of every sane person there is, and his campaign tanked for a week because of it. He engaged in a Twitter fight with Alicia Mercado, that's the Miss Universe pageant winner, you know, who was an obvious plant and bait by the Clinton team, and he did this for a week as his campaign tanked. This happened a dozen times, all self-inflicted. He took items that should have been, you know, 1 or 2 day news cycle stories and turned them into week-long ones. It was breathtaking in its stupidity. It is difficult for me to empathize with those who stuck with him through these ridiculous, farcical moments in history. Which brings me to the topic of risk. So, from my point of view, the most important lens through which to view this election is that of risk. I have never thought of myself as fundamentally risk-averse, but it turns out that when it comes to civilization, I am absolutely risk-averse. Trump, in my mind, is the pure risk candidate, and the upside is just a bunch of supply-side mumbo-jumbo with a downside that goes as deep as it gets. Hillary Clinton is obviously the safe candidate, obviously. I mean, I'm glossing over the constant flirtations with racist language and the misogyny and the rest. Those things disqualified Trump for me for sure, and I absolutely disagree with him on trade and immigration. But even putting those things aside, I'm talking about the risk associated with having someone so poorly controlled by himself and his advisors and handing him the keys to the most powerful office in the world. The most powerful office is the most dangerous office. That means the same thing. And now we are left hedging our bets that all of this was just caricature and bullshit and theater. You know, a ploy for votes or camera time or the stroking of ego or what have you. The clear ignorance Trump exhibits on every subject he speaks about. You know, his ongoing attempts to silence his critics in the press, to silence his critics in the citizenry, his endless litigation and threats of litigation. I mean, this is by any measure a ridiculously vindictive person. The evidence that this was all sham and that he'll govern with sanity and a cool head is not good. It's not good. For my part, it seems non-existent. And I have lost a lot of sleep over it, to be quite honest. I am not saying that metaphorically. I mean that literally. I absolutely hope I am 100% wrong about this guy. Of course, the big elephant in the room is the racism and the other isms. There's been a lot of soul searching on the left in the aftermath of this election. There seems to be a sobering consensus from the less extreme side of the left that despite the repeated race baiting throughout Trump's campaign, the courting of racial violence at his rallies, you know, the misogynistic blurbs, the endorsement of the KKK and so on, that despite all of that, racism and other isms simply cannot explain 47% of the electorate. It is not plausible racism was the driving motivation for so many millions of voters. And I absolutely share this view. And I think the far left that sees racists everywhere are getting their causality backwards, or at least conflating correlation with causation. You know, let me give a sense of this using some made-up numbers just for illustration purposes. On a scale of 1 to 100, racism has gone from 90 in the 1920s to 10 today. But the far left continually hammers us as if it were still at 90, and this is bound to get tiresome and cause resentment in large percentages of the population. It has been tiresome for a long time. The attention and virtue signaling paid to racism, disproportionate to its actual level, shows you that warriors of this kind of justice they're just eternally dissatisfied. You know, they are on a mission to get that level to zero, not realizing that the ability to do so faces diminishing returns, as everything does, because the closer you get, the harder it gets to take out the next increment. You know, and worse, when you get to a certain point, what increasingly remains is the butting up against the walls of our evolutionary makeup. Evolutionary pressure has favored in-group, out-group tribalism. It has. And we have known this for a long time, that there's a psychological bedrock for proto-racist tendencies among us. There's survival value there when you are a band of nomads and literally everything else on the planet, including the other bands, is hostile. Personally, I do not think it is realistic to believe you can get racism down to zero. You know, but even if you could and believed that to be a worthy goal, I don't think the way you achieve that is by pretending we are still at 1959 levels of racism. I am a minority, as is much of my extended family, and I have experienced racism at a personal level and know very much what the intimidation and loss of dignity feels like. But to deny we have made, as a society, huge progress in the area is to be flagrantly dishonest. The left has been the clear winner in this area of the culture wars, but their power has been unchecked for a long time. You know, demagogues like talk radio hosts Rush Limbaugh and others, you know, they've been pushing back against this for decades to provide a check on the left. And I think we are about to find out what it feels like to have the pendulum swing the other way, and significantly so, having just elected a president whose platform has been just as much about resentment as it has been about enacting trade wars. I worry about this fact, and I regret it. I wish we didn't have to go through what I worry is in front of us. A part of me flirts with the idea that we have to go through that, that we should go through it to exercise some of our insecurities and toughen ourselves in some fashion. I guess I don't know what's coming, but, you know, I guess we hope for the best as far as racism goes. But the unseemliness of what appears to be on the horizon is definitely worrisome. Of course, there were some cultural heroes that emerged as a consequence of this election. Scott Adams is the first one that comes to my mind. Scott Adams is the cartoonist behind Dilbert, and he has made enormous waves with his successful prediction of the Trump election. I believe he made his prediction well over a year ago. So Scott Adams is a trained hypnotist and is a lifelong student of the persuasion arts. He told a story about how during the Republican primaries, he noticed Trump using persuasion techniques at an unusually effective level and was immediately engrossed with the election that led to Adams becoming a central part of the public discussion and has remained so ever since. You know, and that's when he predicted the eventual election of Trump. Scott Adams has also been very vocal that he has been talking only about the art of persuasion, not policy, not, you know, right versus wrong and so on. And I found myself very impressed with Scott Adams' command of what was going on. However, I did eventually tire of it in some regard, because despite Adams's claims to the contrary, his discussion inevitably turned to defending Trump in areas that seem clearly indefensible strictly from the point of view of persuasion. I mean, consider all the stuff I said about risk. You know, there's a very high uncertainty surrounding Trump's future behavior, which seems impossible to deny given his record to date. There doesn't appear to be anything about persuasion that can speak to whether someone really means that they intend to foment nuclear proliferation, as Trump has flirted with, or that U.S. debt is okay to default upon, as Trump has flirted with, or any of the countless other crazy things Trump has said. At best, what we are all hoping for is that all of the lunacy somehow transforms itself into a boring sanity, but I don't see how persuasion techniques offer any prediction as far as that goes. But regardless, I have become a fan of Scott Adams. I have a deep interest in the irrational side of human beings, you know, as taught at a formal level in things like behavioral economics and elsewhere. But Scott Adams has opened my interest to the more pragmatic side of that stuff. You know, it's like taking an academic understanding of things like confirmation bias and turning it into ways of persuading people. I think that's some pretty cool stuff. Another cultural hero, Nate Silver. So Nate Silver is the other superstar of this election. Yet again, he has outforecasted everyone, which probably sounds a little bit ironic given that his forecasts were wrong, but allow me to explain that. On the eve of the election, he estimated Clinton had a 65% chance of winning, with Trump given a 35% chance. Now, contrast that to the New York Times upshot, who had Clinton at 84%, or the Daily Kos, who gave Clinton a 92%. Others, including the betting markets, made similarly outrageous bad forecasts. It's important to understand how these forecasts work. They take hundreds of polls, national and state polls, but mostly state polls we're talking about, these polls come in, you know, more or less continuously every week. And the forecasters apply a mathematical model to them that weights their likelihood of being representative of that particular electorate. So these forecasts changed all the time. And of course, there were also an aggregation of many, many polls. It's not like, you know, the LA Times puts out a poll and the forecaster bases his or her forecast based on that one poll. No, it's based across dozens and hundreds of polls. But again, like I said, these forecasts change all the time, and you could see them rise and fall with the news cycles, like clockwork. Alicia Mercado, the debates, the Hollywood Access tape. Every one of these news events were followed by corresponding movements in the polls and hence the forecasts. On October 28, Hillary Clinton had a national average lead of 8% when FBI Director James Comey dropped his email investigation bomb by reopening the case that had been closed for months. You know, he did this a mere 11 days before the election, and I watched, as I'm sure many of you did, Clinton's lead drop to 3% nationally over the next week, which is where it remained on the eve of the election. Of course, you don't win an election with a national average. You do it state by state. And given that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both had record low favorability ratings all election season long, the number of undecided voters contained in every poll was at a record high. And Nate Silver was explicit for months that undecided voters equaled uncertainty in the polling. And his math model accounted for this uncertainty. And this is the main reason his forecast for Clinton was so low relative to the other forecasters. And, you know, while he clearly got it, quote, wrong, he got it far less wrong than everyone else. Far less. Nailing the 2012 election And getting 49 out of 50 states correct in 2008 made Nate Silver a statistical superstar. And it's no less to his credit that while he got it more wrong this time around, he trounced his fellow forecasters again, and for exactly the correct reason. At a personal level, I found this stuff totally distressing. You know, on October 28, Hillary Clinton had made a very impressive climb over Donald Trump over the previous 5 or 6 weeks, mostly due to her performances in the debates, though we shouldn't ignore the Hollywood sex tape that came out at that time, which hurt Trump significantly. Nate Silver's forecast had Clinton at 84% before the James Comey FBI bomb. Now, of course, it's impossible to know what would have happened had Comey not dropped it, but it is hard to ignore the fact that an 8% lead going into the election almost certainly would have carried the day for Clinton. Contrast that with the 3% lead she ended up with due to that email bomb on the eve of the election. Of course, we'll never know, but that final week was a nail-biter for me, and as we watched the race get tighter and tighter, I experienced a lot of stress that week, no doubt about it. So my thoughts end up at question, where do we go from here? I have to admit I have never personally suffered after an election like I have this one. I got an average of 2 to 3 hours of sleep over the 3 days that followed the election and found myself with almost no appetite to speak of. I must have been riding on nervous energy because I still managed to go to work, though I was rather unproductive. I know many of you experienced the exact same thing, judging by the organic protests that have emerged throughout the country, and the fact that they persist tells me this election was very special indeed. In my lifetime, major events that stick out, you know, like a sore thumb, global and national events, they're few. 9/11 tops the list. The Challenger explosion in 1986, that rocked my world as a kid. The Berlin Wall coming down was one. Something tells me this election will rank high in our collective memories for the remainder of our lives. I know to Trump supporters, this is a beacon of hope, and I certainly will not despair them for having the feelings they do. But to me, the Trump election is a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy, and with a very high degree of uncertainty. It feels like I will consider ourselves lucky if all that transpires is 4 boring years with the expectation of the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, the repeal of Roe versus Wade, some various attacks on the progress made in the LGBT community, major repeals of efforts made to combat anthropogenic global warming, and of course we can look forward to building a wall and shutting down entry of members of one of the world's major religions. Frankly, I find it hard to muster hopeful words about all of this. I made a promise with myself before the election. In fact, I intended to make a podcast episode to make a public record of this promise, but as I said, the launching of my podcast was stalled due to my attention being pulled away. But the promise I made was this: if after a year, my major prediction about the winner turns out to be false, I promise to publicly rebuke my position and apologize for it. Of course, at the time, I thought I would be talking about Clinton, and the idea was that after a year, she would be scandal-free and drama-free and governing more or less from the center, and that if significant portions of this picture I painted ended up being incorrect, I needed to apologize for it. After all, with our individual votes, we are all, in some sense, accomplices to what our elected officials do. But now we're talking about Donald Trump, and the same standard has to apply. I have accused him of being a sociopathic bullshitter and totally lacking of self-control and a cool head and not knowing much of anything of substance. If after a year he surprises me and gets his shit together, I need to publicly acknowledge this and apologize for my disparagement of him. So today I promise to do exactly that. And given how high the emotions have run on this election, perhaps you will consider making a similar pledge to reflect on your contribution to this election a year from now and make a correction if it's warranted. Thank you for listening.